Yeah, all my coworkers are we're all freaking out today about the election.
They weren't happy.
They were not happy.
They're gonna move out of New York.
I think it's a little late in the day for them. they're locked in. It's like they own houses on Staten Island, you know.
So most of your coworkers do live in New York City.
Yes, actually. Okay. Bizarrely, on this job, most of them do.
So they they have a right to be mad about this, but sure. If you could pinpoint what their central problems were, what was it?
Well, you know, I've been thinking about this. There's jokes, right? Like, people have been joking about what happens when Kami Mandami comes to power, and executions and Sharia law and, like, getting used to knowing what direction Mecca is, blah, blah, blah. But these are all kind of jokes. More seriously, I think that the guy who took it the harshest was the oldest guy, and I don't think that that's an accident. I think that, you know, the operating engineer who's 60-something years old is responding to this in a way that, like, younger people aren't. When I said something like, Nikki, relax. We survived de Blasio, right? He's like, de Blasio was an American. Like, say what you want about the guy. He wasn't a Muslim, you know, this whole fucking thing. And, you know, there's no way politically that people like Nikki who live on Staten Island and are in their 60s are going to be, like, moved in a positive political direction. Like, these people are set for life, you know.
Do you think they can retire
and then move to Florida, I guess, where politics are better for them.
So do you think that is, like, purely anti-Muslim or anti-immigrant xenophobia, or do you think there's also an element to, like, where Zoran reads as being, like, a rich kid to a lot of people?
I haven't heard that specifically. I think that is, like, a real element. You know, I was trying to process it today in anticipation of this episode, and also because, you know, Columbia University censored the panel I was supposed to be on last weekend. I don't know if I told you about that thing.
Yeah, that's so a story, too.
I have a lot of spare thoughts hanging around, and one of them, I think, in reaction to speaking with, like, my older coworker on this, is that there's actually two traumas, you know, at work in the anti-Zoran sort of hysteria, which we went through for months and unfortunately is not ending. We'll go on for the next 4 years, maybe not nationally, but you remember New York City under de Blasio. There was a constant drumbeat from mostly the New York Post, but also the Daily News and others, that scandalized so many things. And there was, like, this constant sort of drumbeat of the city's falling apart. Like, this sleepy progressive guy is, like, destroying the city and bringing Sandinista visions or whatever. So that stuff is real. Like, you have to live with that. But the open wound, you know, 9/11 in this city is still a trauma, and it's still one that very successfully can be used against people, especially people who either lost loved ones or were, like, greatly affected by it. And it was 25 years ago, so there's a lot of those people. But, like, there's another kind of trauma, I think, that an open wound that we don't talk about and wasn't used against Mandami, and one that, like, I think affects older people and kind of affects all of our politics. And that's the trauma of deindustrialization. And this has kind of been, from the beginning, my drumbeat on the Zoran campaign, which is, like, what does socialism look like? Not just in one city, but one city that within Nick's lifetime lost a million manufacturing jobs, over a million manufacturing jobs, which went through a process of, like, rapid deindustrialization, rising crime rates, a complete, like, demographic shift, and the shift from an industrial city, manufacturing city, into, like, a services and finance and media economy, right? What do we imagine socialism could do in this instance? And I think that trauma of deindustrialization, which is to say the trauma of the progress of capitalism, the movement of accumulation, and its aftermath, is an unresolved one. And it's one that maybe Zoran's election could have been used as an opportunity to bring that up, bring up the question of jobs, bring up the question of capital, bring up the question of mobility of labor, mobility of people, mobility of capital. But instead, that wasn't done. And all we got instead was, if you elect this guy, he's going to arrest Bibi Netanyahu, which would be a good thing in my eyes. He's going to do another 9/11 like he did in 2001 when he was 10 years old. Works very effectively on a lot of very, very stupid people and very scared people.
You think some people voted for him because they wanted another 9/11? The Zoomers missed it. They want to see what it was the fuss was about.
Yeah, they wanted to wake up one beautiful September morning and have the 20th century end violently in front of their eyes. I mean, maybe we should end the 21st century that way. I don't know. Maybe it's time to... I think the 21st century might have been a failure.
Yeah, they built
maybe
that new tower. You know, it's just sitting there. You know, the city of New York probably owns some planes. All right, but so you...
What's your... That's like my beginnings of a take.
No, this is good. And this is, yeah. I'm thinking along the same lines too, because obviously I think I've expressed my view on Zoran on the show before, which is that I don't really believe in social democracy. I don't really think that Mayor Mamdani on his own is going to change anything. I root for him because I tend to like social democrats and like my friends, you know, my friends who are working so hard for this and are so inspired by this. I'm happy for them. So I'm like, I went to the like three different victory parties just to like see right. the scene and like,
get a vibe check, feel the joy.
As we did after Biden won, we went to Prospect Park and lived out too. And did the electric
with
slide.
Matt Chrisman and Amber. Yeah,
so I feel it's the same, exact same thing kind of, you know, but I think also we should challenge ourselves not to just be like, oh, here's your fell for it again award. You're going to need this, you know, maybe things, yeah. Which may try to like think about how things are a little different this time. And I found one theory that speaks to what you're saying about New York being a post-industrial city. This is from a city exit poll that says how different communities voted. And Zoran won with households below median income, households at or above median income. He got 50%. Public transit riders, he got 58%. Renters, he got 57%. NYCHA developments, 55%. Two categories listed here where Cuomo won was drivers and homeowners, which he won 53% to 51%. And Daniel Bessner of the American Prospects interprets this is what a post-industrial class coming into being looks like. Basically, we have a class recognizing itself as an object of history, but what makes this class of non-capital holders unique in the last 200 years is that, unlike the industrial workers, it is not necessarily key to the economy. As Melinda Cooper details on an episode of The Dig, our political economy is organized around asset and capital inflation, not production of industrial goods by workers. And I don't totally follow that last point so much, but I would add to that that I think this Mamdani coalition, which in many ways looks like the Trump coalition or is parallel to it, and the question of affordability, now Trump is like, oh, I'm going to go back to the affordability thing. Yeah. I think it's a question of not production, but consumption, because we're in a situation where because of rising wealth inequality, the concentration of wealth, all of the consumption, which is very important to the U.S. economy, is like it's like a third of the U.S. GDP or something like that. All the consumption is being done by a small group of people who therefore 10%. Have a massive amount of political capital, and the 80% of people outside that circle are having declining consumption, rents going up, buy less food, you know, get a shittier car, ride your bike to work, that sort of thing. And
not
so
to
this
mention,
is
healthcare taking up more and more, fractions of people's disposable income as well, you know?
And so I think this populist revolt on both the right and the left is something like the class of the declining, the consumers with declining capabilities, saying fuck you to the establishment in one way or another, with or without hope.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. No, I think you're right to bring up the politics of consumption as opposed to the politics of production, which did not really enter into this campaign. I mean, what could a New York mayor do about that? I mean, what could a New York mayor do about Israel Palestine? Right. These are that was one thing that was very frustrating from the very beginning of this was. To as a lifelong resident of this place, you know, you and I, this is our home, to see local issues, to see local politics become a national story. It's something that this is not the first time it's happened, and it won't be the last time either. But so much gets lost in translation between living here on a day-to-day basis and, you know, the way that this city is portrayed in the national news. But I agree, there is something like a consumer. Let's like, what would you call it? Like a lower class, because you don't want to use working class. This is like about income. There's like a lower class sort of cohort.
What they're saying,
politics arising right now.
A lot of these lefty pollsters are calling this cohort the broad middle.
The broad middle. Okay,
because
interesting.
Because, you know, Zoran does well with lower income voters until you get to 30,000. And that's the same. That's the same sort of realignment we've seen towards Trump. Is that
$30,000 a year?
Yeah. So, you know, he wins.
People live on that in New York City?
Yeah, of course. I did for a long time.
Yeah, no, I guess I did too, but things have gotten so expensive.
And I wonder if part of that is Orthodox Jewish voters, because that people don't, for whatever reason, people don't believe this, but Orthodox Jewish voters tend to be very, very poor. Or in fact, Jews in general tend to be very, very poor, especially Hasidics. The Hasidim, I mean. So I wonder if that is a factor in Cuomo winning that. He didn't win it, you know, vastly, but that was just one category he beats Mamdani in.
Yeah, I'm one block. I shouldn't, like, location dox myself, but I live very close to Borough Park, which I believe was plus 60. Andrew Cuomo. And Borough Park isn't only Satmars, but it's mostly Hasidic people. But being on that border, I have to say, I had a voting experience, and I don't always vote. I had a voting experience which was very, very touching, actually. Like, I'm not sure what I believe. Like, I believe in a pluralistic politics, but I believe in a pluralistic society. And I, going into the polling booth, it was one third, just like regular, like white, Spanish, black American folks. And then it was like one third Muslim, you could tell, like Bangladeshi folks wearing headdress and whatever. And then one third Hasidic Jews. And everybody kind of coming together into this room and like casting ballots for who knows who, maybe there were Muslims who voted for Cuomo and the whole thing. But it really puts things into perspective when you're in a room like that in a public high school in New York City, like watching people do this very, like, of course, we know, insufficient thing politically, but also to like puts lie to, I think, what so many people tried to do nationally and internationally to try to turn this into a referendum on the left and anti-Semitism and Israel and Palestine and Islam in general, Islamism, you know, that just wasn't, I did not see that on the streets whatsoever. I didn't see that in the polling booths. I didn't see that in my neighborhood, which is essentially a DMZ between the two groups in question here. I actually have a lot more faith, I feel like, in New Yorkers to deal with one another on a basic day-to-day level than I think anybody in national politics or national media does.
Even people like Nikki?
Even people like Nikki, I think that...
Because you see them as being kind, you know, they would be kind to Zoran if he was working with you, but as a politician, he just becomes a vector for that hatred.
Yeah, and I think it's very sad. I think it's very sad that people like Nikki allow themselves to have this like otherizing alien view of people who, you know, I live around plenty of Muslims. There's like the call to prayer five times a day. You can hear it from our apartment, and it's just not, it's not this hysterical thing that people are talking about. People go to work. They fucking live their lives. They go shopping. They do their fucking thing. They take their kids to school. It's just normal, everyday American life. That's it.
and you know that sort of anti-elitism combined with xenophobia against aliens transitions very well to what we'll be talking about in the second half of the episode.
Yes.
The film Begonia with guest film critic Peyton McCarty Simmons. But I want to say a few more things about Z-Day before we move there.
Z-Day.
So yeah, it's interesting to hear your perspective. Yeah, I feel like you got this perspective from like the job site and from a more working class neighborhood. My perspective, of course, is from right in the heart of the commie corridor.
Commie corridor,
in Ridgewood,
so called.
Queens. And just for weeks, I've seen these Zoron canvassers who are increasingly wearing this kind of, I don't know, like scout uniform of like the blue Zoron shirt and the yellow beanie. Knocking on doors, you know, they were ubiquitous up here. I don't know if it was the same everywhere. Knocking on doors at the polling site and very chipperly just trying to have conversations with anyone about Zoron. And so just walking around, like walking past the polling place for the last couple of weeks, I get little snippets of these conversations, and I think it's really incredible. Sometimes, you know, sometimes they're just talking about the bread and butter issues, the free buses, free daycare, that sort of thing. But, you know, I think those conversations can very quickly spin out to really serious conversations about the nature of politics, class struggle, you know, fascism, authoritarianism, socialism, why should I even vote, you know, things like that. And so I think it's a really beautiful thing to see that stuff play out. You know, it's, I agree, yeah. There's like a civic positivity or optimism there, because I didn't, you know, some of these conversations I could tell they were difficult, you know, largely they were about identity, which is sort of what we're talking about too.
Yes.
But you know, neighbors need to talk to each other about our views on identity and that sort of thing.
Yeah. I was curious today, because they said there was record turnout. I think twice as many New Yorkers showed up to vote for mayor as last time around for Eric Adams. And I was looking, and I even posted it in our little document that we have here of the historic voting numbers for mayoral elections in New York City. And you see a precipitous drop off at exactly that time of deindustrialization in the 1960s and 1970s. It goes from participation rates of like 90%. There's like a steep decline in the late 60s and early 1970s.
Yeah, this
and
was like, the most votes in a mayor election since Lindsay in 65.
Right. So we get down to 26, and I think now we're back up into the 50s or whatever. So like on the socialism question, because, you know, obviously that's one of the main points of our show, right, is to look at questions like this. You know, there is like a great insufficiency at the heart of this in my mind. And this was something I was going to talk about in that canceled before Columbia University canceled me and my colleague, Eric Foner, from this panel for, I guess we were going to maybe say something about Israel. I didn't even intend to, but anyways, it got canceled for reasons.
For
thought crime. Curtis Silva. Who I will admit, when a Quinnipiac pollster called me a couple of weeks ago, I said was my second choice. I think he is over Andrew Cuomo, who I just find a detestable individual.
Many are saying this, yes.
So Silva, there's that great
Sliwa.
Sliwa, thank you. I can't say. See, I'm equal opportunity. I can't say Sliwa and I can't say Mamdani. So you know, between the two,
you can
of
call
them,
him Curtis.
I can say Cuomo.
You ever listen to Curtis and Kuby back in the day? That was a great show.
No, I didn't.
Sliwa had a morning radio show with legendary leftist lawyer Ron Kuby.
See, that's awesome. I feel like he's such a gadfly. He's such like a crank, you know, Curtis. But, you know, there's that great, I don't know if you saw that clip that was circulating where he's like, and maybe you can bring it up and play the audio, but it's on like the Morton Downey Jr. show or some shit in the 1990s. He's like, we got this organization, the Guardian Angels. This guy, he's a Palestinian. This other guy in the group, he's a Jew, and they fuck it. They hate each other. They hate each other. But they're both part of the same organization. And when they come together in our civic association, they squash their beef, and they're just here as Guardian Angels together, you know, which obviously that's not socialism, right? But like that vision of how difference is encountered and overcome, the idea of like organization, of like civil society and organizing within it as a way to like change the world, is something that Republicans, and Sliwa, of course, ran as a Republican and won as a Republican, won the primary anyways, they're always nodding towards this entire thing. I think cynically and opportunistically, because they don't actually believe that people should have their own organizations and their own fighting associations, certainly not working class people, right? However, that said, like that vision of how society changes and how we change society and how people grab back power, I think is actually ultimately more convincing in a medium to longer term than the idea that you're going to have like free public goods, or that you're going to have, you know, free childcare, or you're going to have rent freezes, and that's some sort of path towards socialism. I think that the Zoran candidacy and now mayoralty, which we're going to live through for the next 4 years, is a great opportunity for us. And this is why I don't shit on the whole thing. Great opportunity for people like you and me and hundreds of thousands of other people out there to think deeply about these questions of what would socialism look like, not just in one city, but what would it look like in the 21st century under conditions, under class structures, under the organic composition of capital, under the geopolitics that we have in this world, which seriously forces us to rethink things. That's kind of where I'm at with this whole thing.
All right. Well, two thoughts on that. One is that I think, I watched this interesting aesthetic convergence between Zoran and Sliwa, not so much about politics, but just around a certain attitude towards New York City, which is we love this city. We love its diversity. We love to get there on the street and talk to New Yorkers and shoot the shit and have arguments. Maybe we're going to be better at solving our problems than someone like Cuomo, who's just a detestable ghoul who ran this campaign of like, you can't have anything. And if you don't vote for me, this is going to be a caliphate.
Right. And also, he's like a carpetbagger in his own fucking city.
Yeah,
like,
he's not a New Yorker.
Fucking 65 years ago, hasn't taken the train in decades, you know?
For example, on Halloween, I saw tons of Guardian Angel costumes. So there's this kind of admiration amongst the left here in the Cobham Corridor for Sliwa and the Guardian Angels. And to that, I would just say that Sliwa does talk he code switches, much like Mondani, but not like, not in terms of accent, in terms of like, if he's on a Republican radio show, he sounds just like any psycho. He sounds like Mark Levin, you know? He knows how to talk to different audiences. He's very good at it. He's a bullshitter. He's a liar, you know? So, he has like very smartly won over a lot of Mondani people. Not that he's Jesse Waters or anything. He's more interesting than that. But all right. So the other thing I'll say is that talking about, do people believe in the free buses and free daycare stuff? Like, I don't see why they shouldn't. These things are possible. There's reason to believe that the establishment, whether it be Hochul or Trump, will stop it. Mm. But I think it's a vote to fight, and not necessarily to fight for those things, because I think Mamdani will fight for those things, and maybe he'll win, maybe he won't. But it's just a vote to fight in general. I think that's what this sort of blue wave was. And right. I think Cuomo's best argument, if I were a voter, which I've voted in the past, but I haven't voted anytime recently, and I were like thinking about who I should vote for, who would be best for me, I might be a little bit compelled by Cuomo's argument that's like, Trump is going to invade the city. Mm. And he was going to do this in 2020 when he called New York City an anarchist jurisdiction. Mm. And I talked him out of that. Mm-hmm. And if you elect Zoran, he's definitely going to do that, because Trump's rhetoric recently has been, if you elect Zoran, then I'm going to treat New York City like Cuba or Venezuela. Right. And that's not an idle threat. He's going to shut off funds to the city. He's going to lay siege to the city. He's going to invade it. He's going to kill people.
Yeah.
Maybe it's better to have Cuomo in that situation. I'm not saying I think this. I'm just saying like that's a very compelling argument.
It's a compelling argument.
And people know it.
And Cuomo's a prick. Everyone knows he's a fucking prick. He sat up in Albany. Remember when he and the other Democrats created like a fake breakaway Democratic Party so they didn't have to like do anything? Do you remember that whole thing?
Yeah.
Like
the IDC.
Yes. the IEDC. Thank you. It is very compelling. It's a compelling argument. It's compelling in construction because, you know, we have this new gleaming LaGuardia Airport, which used to be a third world shithole. I think it was called under Trump, which was pretty much correct. We have a new Kennedy Airport, which is in the process of being completed right now. We've got all sorts of new bridges. We got all sorts of new tunnels. That money comes because we had Andrew Cuomo, you know, knocking heads together up in Albany. We had fucking Chuck Schumer as the Senate leader. So we were getting all this money. If you're like a deeply cynical person, then you say like, sure, Cuomo, you know, he gets the goods. And that's like employment in a way that, like, if Zoran's like a consumer's candidate, then Cuomo, if you're in construction, is like a producer's candidate, right? Like, mm-hmm. he's going to mobilize the federal and state funds necessary to keep us working, keep us productive, you know, working on infrastructure or whatever. So there is an interesting dynamic there, but I think that what we're about to see over the next 3 years, because it's not gonna be 4 years because Trump will be presumably out of office, is going to be a very epic sort of like political showdown. Very similar to one commentator was pointing out how when Margaret Thatcher became prime minister, Ken Livingstone became the mayor of London, was like this like commie mayor, and the two of them like played off one another, and it played to both of their benefits. So I feel like Mamdani is going to actually fight. I think he'll actually be able to fight in much more interesting ways than Cuomo would fight, and in ways that might expand politics as opposed to foreclosing it. And I would say, as a last thing, one of the things that's very disappointing and one of the things you would look for if you had a socialist candidate for mayor is a way to do something even like reforming Democrats did with like the church committee in the 1970s or various like rules making bodies, which is to like devolve some power, to actually change the way that politics in the city works in a way that like can lead to change in the future, empowering like working class New Yorkers to actually have more of a say in decisions and say like community advisory boards over the police department, things that are like would really make a dent in the way that power operates in the city. I think it's stark that he didn't actually talk about that.
No, he did. He doesn't talk about it much, but he does have these proposals. Like for example, he was asked about fixing the school system, and his whole proposal around that is he's going to make teachers, students, and parents a more important voice in how the school systems run. And then, you know, police accountability boards, obviously that's a big thing for him. He's going to try to empower that. So he does talk, but I agree. He didn't run on like democratizing the city. That wasn't the campaign slogan.
No, it's not. And maybe it's naive to suppose that he would, maybe in his second term, he would. Right. But like what, we're told that he's like accountable to DSA. Well, like who's DSA accountable? You know, like they have a lot of members in this city, right? But do we truly believe that, like,
well, he doesn't say he's accountable to DSA. I mean, we can presume. No, you know, DSA people might say that, but
DSA claims that he's accountable to them. Okay. Right. And like who's DSA accountable? Like, do we truly believe that DSA in its current instantiation here in New York City represents the working class of this city? Mm-hmm. They represent like a certain fraction of that class, right, for sure. And they attempt to try to theorize and pull together policies that they believe would be empowering for working class New Yorkers. But like, if you had a socialist candidate, I believe that it would be, they would be empowered and held to account by a series of like independent working class institutions and organizations, which like would actually be the filter through which like actual policy would come from the class, like actual like lawmaking would actually bubble up from the class itself with its various organs and force upon the mayor solutions, class solutions to class problems, to the extent that you could even do that in one city. So again, we will be pointing to, not in like a stupid like, oh, he's such a disappointment, or oh, he's a sellout, or oh, he's just a Democrat. That shit's real fucking boring. But what I think we should spend the next 3 years doing, and I think you and I will do, is look at the ways in which like this politics might point beyond itself towards something different, and how we might imagine that different politics.
Yeah, arising. I agree. I am like, you know, his slogan the last few weeks has been, this is our moment. And I don't think this is our moment. I think what's most inspiring about his victory, the sheer fact that he won the bare majority of voters in this huge turnout election, in which, you know, but your point's very good that, like, you know, Trump calls him a communist and we're like, oh no, he's a social democrat or whatever. But, like, you know, he is part of the DSA, and the DSA has a lot of communists in it. So, like, mm-hmm. he's not too far off there. And I think people know that. People think, like, well, maybe he is a communist, but they voted for him anyway.
Right.
Maybe Trump will invade the city, and, like, people know that that might happen, and people still voted for him. And so I think that's pretty inspiring. And the reason why I don't think that's just, like, going to the ballot box, that will to fight, it's not just a ballot, was that 2 weeks ago, on October 23rd, ICE made its first real show of force in the streets of New York City.
Canal Street.
Yeah, they rolled a tank down Canal Street, mm-hmm. had dozens of federal troops, including ICE, just, you know, rampaging, like, trying to grab anyone that looked like a foreigner. You know, from the videos of it, it appears that people immediately fought back, and these videos are incredible, because it's not like the Black Bloc. It wasn't activists. I mean, I'm sure people like that were there, but I work in that area all the time. I know exactly what that neighborhood looks like at that time of day when that raid happened. And the people who were physically confronting ICE are just the normal people you see around, going to lunch, shopping, stretching, you know, going out of their apartment and taking a stretch, you know, and dozens of people were, like, immediately fighting. And I said in a statement that they weren't able to complete their operation because people were, you know, maybe they were lying, but, like, they claimed that there was a riot that stopped them from doing what they're trying to do. Wow. So I think people are ready to fight. And we've seen it in LA, yeah. We've seen it in Chicago, and now we're almost definitely going to see it in New York.
And one thing that's going to potentially save us, well, two things there. I forget if it was Financial Times or New York Times. These are the two main things that I read. But there was somewhere where Trump was expressing privately, according to people on the inside of the White House, some grudging admiration for him. Like, Trump's one of these people where it's like, game recognized game, you know, right. He apparently said, like, oh, he's very charismatic and telegenic and blah, blah, blah. So he hates his politics, but, like, Trump's weird in that, like, he respects a good opponent. And so, like, the two of them, I think maybe are going to feed off of one another, which will be very, very interesting to watch. But the other thing too, is that, like you said, I think people are ready to go to war, but Trump also, unlike in Chicago and LA, has, like, massive real estate interests in New York City.
Yeah.
And so he actually fundamentally doesn't want this city to fall apart or to
He's probably getting Bill Ackman type people being like, all right, chill out. This isn't a dinky little town like Chicago. because I think actually he was going to invade San Francisco, and the mayor there talked him out of it, like, backed by a bunch of, you know, whatever tycoons are in Trump's ears. Yeah, can you actually please not do this? This will be bad for us.
Yeah. And so, I think it's the last thing I'll say on this, because I think we're pretty much out of time. We'll go talk about the film we all saw. Was, you know, outside of all the fucking hysteria outside of X.com, the Everything app, formerly Twitter, just the complete meltdown that national media has been having about this election, about issues that really are tangential to it, like Israel. It's only interesting to bring up vis-a-vis this election because Zohran was really the first mainstream, like, national politician to come out and say, like, you know, no, I won't go to Israel. No, blah, blah, blah. So he's like an anti-Zionist guy, I guess, in that way. So that makes it interesting. But, you know, outside of all this hysteria, I got a nice email from the union, and they said, like, we have contacted Zohran, and we have congratulated him. I'll just read it. We congratulate Mayor-elect Mamdani on his victory in this year's general election. As always, the New York City and vicinity District Council of Carpenters stands ready to work with the incoming administration to create more union jobs, ensure safer work sites, and end worker exploitation. Even though we did not not endorse him, the mayor-elect pledged to uphold the those values, as he did in Albany, where he fought to advance Carpenter priorities as an assemblyman. So on top of, like, outside of Twitter, outside of Fox News or the New York Post, outside of Nikki from Staten Island, who I work with, the crane operator, right? Like, the real working class institutions, such as they still exist in this country, these backwards reactionary ones are like, oh, election's over. Okay, we're going to work with this guy now, like we do with everybody else, you know?
The wheel still turns. All right.
Wheel's still turning.
So we're going to move to part two of this episode. We're going to be talking about the new movie Begonia, starring Jesse Plemons and Emma Stone. It will be extremely spoiler heavy after the first 5 or 6 minutes, and this is a movie that you do not want to have spoiled. So if you haven't seen the movie, you know, don't listen. And our guest,
sign up for our Patreon.
Yeah, our guest.
Don't listen to it.
Yeah. Or, you know, don't see the movie and just listen to the episode. So we've got a guest for that. That is Peyton McCarty Simmons. They are a film critic whose work has appeared in The Hollywood Reporter and Brooklyn Rail, and they are the author of That Very Witch, Fear, Feminism, and American Witch Film, and very relevant to the discussion, One Step Short of Crazy, National Treasure, and the Landscape of American Conspiracy Culture. So we're going to talk a lot about the Jesse Plemons conspiracy character and the conspiratorial nature of this film. And so to listen to that, please go to patreon.com/thiswreckage and sign up at any level. If you sign up for a year at the $100 or $150 level, there's a couple of free books in it for you, including my book and Jared Shanahan's book. All info, you'll find that on the pin post on the Patreon. Please support the show and hear part two of this episode.
Yes, and thanks again for listening. And do join us for the next 3 to 4 years while we, as we said in this episode, unpack this whole phenomenon from ground zero. It's happening right here as we speak.
We will be on the scene for 9/11 too.
9/11 too, return of 9/11. Well, we hope to see you there.
Yeah, I saw this movie again yesterday, which is good because it's kind of two movies in a way. You know what I mean? There's like the movie you think it is and the movie that it actually is. So it's fun to see it again.
Yeah, I'm bummed I didn't have time to do it again. I have so many thoughts. I feel like it definitely benefits from multiple viewings. I'm open to multiple readings of the film. I mean, it's a really open text. I think my perspective on it is definitely colored more by the framing and some of the narrative choices than the structure, which is the most interpretable thing about it. But you know, I'm open to lots of other opinions on it as well. It's just been really interesting to see how people have reacted to the things that made me annoyed. Like, I feel kind of nuts. Well, am I the only person who feels that way?
That's how I felt on our last episode when me and Sean talked about One Battle After Another, which I did not particularly like. I also saw it twice, trying to like it the second time, and I just felt the same way. But everyone I know loved it so much. I finally met some people who feel the same way I do. But for a while, I just like, what is wrong with me? Why didn't I like this movie? I have to see it again. But yeah, I think it's good to maybe have some disagreements about this, because there were some, you know, some things that I thought didn't totally make sense, so we're lacking. But I really love this movie. Should we start out with just trying to summarize it before we get to spoiler zone?
Sure. I mean, it's about a conspiracy theorist and his brother or his cousin who's developmentally disabled, who have created a paranoid potential delusion about a girl boss CEO thinking that she's an Andromedan. So they kidnap her in an attempt to save the human race. And it's a game of cat and mouse and intellectual chess between the two, really, Jesse Plemons' character and Emma Stone's character, using this third character as a pawn, and hijinks ensue, and then spoiler seven.
Hijinks is an interesting way to put the climax of the movie, which is kind of just a nonstop